This time, Martin O'Neill restores Celtic's pride. Welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a podcast in which football fans attempt the seemingly impossible to rank once and for all who are the greatest teams of all time. My name's Graham Dunn, as ever, trying to make the case for Oxford United. Very difficult to do in this instance, but I will do it at every opportunity. And joining us, our king of data, it's Jamie Rooney.
Graham, good evening again. We've travelling around the British Isles now. We've kind of come full circle from our joys in Borussia Dortmund, across the sea to Northern Ireland. Now here we are in one of the homes of football, Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a brilliant story. We haven't actually done a Scottish club side, if you exclude, was it Queen's Park?
Almost won the FA Cup.
That was a century before. We are making it a little bit more up-to-date and delighted to be joined this week by Celtic season ticket holder Martin Ferguson. Hi, Martin.
Hello, Graham. Hello, Jamie. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have someone who actually goes to see Celtic regularly. That's a prime example. What I like about this is sort of a continuation of, by accident, we're just continuing the Martin O'Neill story, really. So last week we were talking about Northern Ireland and the 1982 World Cup, where Martin O'Neill had quite a significant part to this. And Martin O'Neill is an incredible part of this story, of course. But when we do the Northern Ireland story, we were reliving some of the great home internationals, or whether the old home international tournament was really ever that special. I don't know. I mean, do you have fond memories of the home internationals?
I think being a Scotland supporter, you have to reach quite far to find fond memories. I mean, I don't have childhood memories of us winning a lot of things. And my earliest football memories go back to the 1986 World Cup, believe it or not. Which was in Mexico, and I recall, you know, we'd have to either stay up late to watch games live or watch the highlights in the morning. And, you know, I think we went into that tournament with sort of high-ish expectations. What usually happens with Scotland is we find ways to lose, although we kind of do ourselves proud. And, you know, Gordon Strachan's famous goal against West Germany, we lost a fantastic Denmark team and we were kicked off the part of a Uruguay when Gordon Strachan was assaulted in the first 60 seconds of that particular match. And that is only one tournament, but that's sort of my memories of being a Scotland fan, which is, you know, big games, big excitement, big expectation, but maybe not that many great results to think about or to remember. I think more recently, obviously, things have got a bit better under the under Steve Clark. If we've got any fit players left at the time we get to Germany, maybe there's an opportunity to get through the group stages for the first ever time, but we won't get too excited.
That Uruguay game, I remember. Is that one where the referee sort of, I think he accidentally sends someone off after about 2 minutes, doesn't he? He seems surprised when he's put the red card out.
Well, it was less than 60 seconds, I think, or less than 90 seconds when the assault took place. Yeah. And then they proceeded to cheat and dive and punch their way through the remaining 89 minutes. But to be fair, we had a lot of really good players in that team. Sort of before my era, as much as that's my earliest memory. So I think with the benefit of hindsight, that was maybe a good opportunity for Scotland to qualify for my group stages. But it wasn't to be, of course.
On reflection, I think Scotland were just super unlucky to catch Denmark at their very first World Cup, where normally they would have been seeded in the fourth bracket, so they would have been the whipping boys, but they were far from the whipping boys. They went into the World Cup as one of the favourites.
Oh, we got the Laudrups and Brevin Elkjær and all these fantastic, they played the big clubs in Europe. Yeah, they were a fantastic team, absolutely fantastic. And of course, the Germans got to the final, and the Uruguayans were, you know, the Uruguayans. Not necessarily the Uruguayan team you would get now, but certainly, you know, a very difficult team to beat.
We're looking at this Celtic team, which Martin O'Neill comes through the door in the 2000 season. He comes in at a pretty strange period for Celtic, isn't it?
His arrival came at the end of a pretty disastrous season, but I think, from my perspective, And for my sort of tenure as a supporter, I sort of go back to 1988. And I'll explain why. So 1988 was obviously the centenary year for Celtic. It was our 100th anniversary. Billy McNeil had come back as manager. Davey Hay had left and he'd come back as manager. He had been the manager between 78 and 83 before he went down south. But he was back and it was a really special year for the club. But we'd lost a lot of really big name players. I mean, if you just think about, Brian McClare went to Man United, Mo Johnston went to Nantes, Murdo McLeod, fantastic midfielder, went to Borussia Dortmund, Alan McInally went down to Aston Villa, you had Danny McGrain, who was maybe our best ever fullback and maybe one of Britain's best ever fullbacks, was at the end of his career, and then David Proben, who many of your listeners might know from Sky Sports over the years, was a fantastic winger, and he retired due to ill health. So he had a whole sort of nucleus of a team sort of left at the end of the 86-87 season. And then what Billy brought in were guys like Andrew Walker from Motherwell, a good goal scorer, but not really a big name. Chris Morris, the Republic of Ireland international, Sheffield Wednesday. Billy Stark and Joe Miller from Aberdeen. Again, good players, good Scottish players, but nothing to set the heather alight. And maybe the biggest name of them all would have been Frank McAvenny, who came back home, having been in West Ham. So we weren't really expected to win the league. If you think back about the 80s in general in Scotland, it was sort of an unusual decade in as much as the first half was all about Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen and Jim McLean's Dundee United. It's the one decade, if you look back at history, where it wasn't all about sort of Celtic and Rangers and maybe one other. These were like fantastic teams and fantastic managers. Of course, the second half of the 80s, it started to change when David Murray became the chairman of Rangers and they started to invest sort of at a level that we'd never really seen before. But the centenary season for Celtic was a bit of magic in the air. We played some great football. We became well known for scoring goals in the last minute, and the Scottish Cup semi-final was scored right at the death to beat Hearts, having been behind. And the Scottish Cup final, McAvenny scored a double, having been 1-0 down, scored twice in the last 10 minutes to win. The season was just sort of magical. And we ended up winning the league with three games to go. I think we beat Dundee 3-0 in front of about 70,000 at Celtic Park. And it was fantastic. It was just really, really special time for us. We won the league by about 10 points. Now, the following year, we managed to win the Scottish Cup against Rangers, but Rangers won the league, and that was their first of the sort of the famed nine in a row. So the sort of the power really shifted across to Ibrox. It was a difficult time from then on, particularly if you were my age and you're going through sort of the end of primary school and into secondary school. Because if you think about it, we lost the Scottish Cup in 1990 to Aberdeen on penalties. And then there was nothing until we got to the final of what was then known as the Coca-Cola Cup. And we played against Raith Rovers, actually at Ibrox. And we were sort of, this was a big moment. It was the first trophy we were going to win for quite some time. Raith Rovers, I think, were in the second tier. And the game went to penalties. And, of course, poor Paul McStay, who'd been such a fantastic player and servant to the club and was coming towards the end of his career, missed the penalty that lost us the final. And I've not cried that many times at football matches throughout my life, but that was certainly the first time. It was such a... And I'll never forget. The game, I think, was in a... It was a Saturday or Sunday, but I do remember that myself, my father, my two brothers, we were all sitting behind the goals where the penalties were taken. And we went straight from there to Mass, believe it or not, to church at Lourdes in Cardonnell in the south side of Glasgow. Celtic doesn't have an exclusively Catholic support, but a lot of people who go to Mass are Celtic supporters. And that's probably the shortest and the quickest and the saddest Mass that I've ever been to. We said a couple of prayers, they blessed us, and we were on our way in about 10 minutes. It was pretty miserable. But it wasn't until the next year, until 95, again, we hadn't won the league, but we managed to win the Scottish Cup. And Tommy Burns was our manager by that time. Yes. And you may recall a big Dutch player, a big Dutch striker called Pierre van Hooijdonk, who we brought in. And big Pierre scored a fantastic header to win the game 1-0. And that was really, such a release, because it had been such a long time. But what is my point of all this? My point really is, for me, between the ages of 8 and 15, we won nothing. And Rangers dominated, and it was crap being a Celtic fan. But also now, as a Celtic supporter, guys my age, or people my age, probably have a much sort of stronger appreciation of winning than what it means and what it takes to win. and you shouldn't take it for granted or get complacent. Because, you know, you do see some of the younger guys or younger people, sorry, who, you know, all they've known really since maybe 2011 has been Celtic success. So when Anil started, you know, he came in year 2000, I think it was June 2008, he was appointed. And it was right off the back of the John Barnes sort of debacle.
Yeah.
I guess for you guys down south, you maybe thought, wow, John Barnes and Kennedy was going up to Scotland, what's going on there? I mean, I don't know what the sort of rationale behind that decision was. What I do know is that Kenny was brought in to give John sort of a bit of air cover to be the sort of the guide. I think Kenny was known as the director of football or something like that. But I remember that season vividly, in as much as I'd actually spent a year in Canada and I was playing football over there. And I mean, go at the weekends to a Celtic supporters club in Calgary, where there was anywhere between 60 and 100 guys, all mostly expat Glaswegians who would come and watch the game. Oh, I mean, we could tell after 5 or 6 games this was a shambles. I mean, he was trying to do this modern 4-2-2-2, which nobody really understood. I mean, it wasn't like he had bad players, really. He had Larson in the team and Berkovic and Viduka and Lambert and various others. It was a strong squad. We couldn't make it click. And then I think the sort of the death knell was the Scottish Cup game against Inverness Cali Thistle, which I'm sure you guys remember as the Super Cali Go Ballistic Celtic are atrocious headline. And Barnes was out of the door. That's not long after that.
That headline is obviously a memorable one. It's the Parisian stuff, or a Liverpool Echo one, aren't they? There's a Liverpool Echo one, and it's actually about Callahan. And so it's in that case, it's Super Cali Ballistic QPR. Atrocious, or QPR atrocious. So,
yeah, I don't know if you've seen Link, the Callahan version, it was pretty embarrassing in any case. Kenny sort of steered the ship until the end of that season. Then, of course, sort of everything changed when O'Neill was appointed.
The 9 in a row, there is one brief moment. And it is surprisingly brief, isn't it, when Vim Jensen comes in and the Rangers are going for this. It appears to be impossible to get 10. I don't know why 10 is so difficult, but it obviously does seem to be for some reason. And so there's this one season where, do you think Celtic earned that league, or was it sort of Rangers just wilting under the pressure of all the legacy and history to it?
Celtic had a very good team that year, but a very good manager. And we also had Henrik Larsson, who at the time we knew was a good player. I mean, in his debut against Hibs at Easter Road, he actually gave the ball away quite early in the first half, and a guy called Chip Charnley put one in from distance, and we all thought, oh my God, who is this guy with the hair and all the rest of it? A little did we know he'd end up being our second best player ever. Did Rangers wilt under the pressure? I don't think so. But again, you know, if you think back, though, Celtic did 9 in a row under Jock Stein starting in the 66-67 season. Rangers did it starting with Souness and ending with Walter Smith. And then Celtic almost did it more recently up until the pandemic, when sort of everything fell apart at Celtic Park. And there's a million reasons for that as well, including the fact that we were in lockdown, COVID. To be fair, I wasn't focusing too much on Rangers at that particular point. But yeah, it was a good team with some good players, and we sort of did what we needed to do, which was stop the 10. Vim left, and I'm sort of sketchy the detail, other than I guess there was sort of there was poor relations between him and Fergus McCann, the owner. I don't think this sort of got on very well. And Jansen had actually been sort of appointed by Jock Brown, who was sort of temporarily the general manager at Celtic, the brother of the Scotland manager, Craig Brown. And he left, and then we brought in a guy called Joseph Venglos. Mm. Now, the football players will know that Venglos was the Czechoslovakia manager back in 76 when they won the Euros and the famous Panenka and all these things, you know. So we brought in a sort of a really well-known, tenured and respected European coach. Joseph Venglos wasn't there for very long. Dr. Joseph wasn't there for very long. He did leave us probably with one extraordinary legacy, which was the signing of a guy called Lubomir Moravcik. Now, again, memory here, I think we signed him from a German club called Duisburg. I think so, but he'd been in France, he'd played at maybe Brest and Saint-Étienne, and I think he'd been linked at Juventus at one point, and he played in the 1991. In any eventuality, when I read in the newspaper, if you remember newspapers, said we'd signed this guy, and I thought, who is that, and why are we signing a guy that's 33? Well, honestly, Graham and Jamie, this guy was arguably the most talented player I've ever seen wear the Celtic jersey. I wasn't old enough to see Jimmy Johnson, obviously, but I mean, Moravcik was an extraordinary football player. It's just a shame we'd gone when he was 33 and not 27. The Kassir is just marvellous to watch. Super intelligent, and as you've probably heard O'Neill say, if you've done all your research, the most two-footed player you've ever seen in your life. This guy didn't have a natural left or right foot. He was two-footed entirely. It was absolutely brilliant. So he was a legacy of the Venglos sort of era before we got into the Field Barnes experiment.
Maybe one positive that comes out of the Barnes experiment is Petrov, isn't it? Because he signs Petrov.
Yeah, Petrov came in. He was just a young boy. I think he was 19. The life thing, I can't remember where we signed him from, other than it was probably like Sofia, I'm going to say.
Cesca Sofia.
Yeah. I knew the same.
Quite a price as well. I think they paid about almost 3 million, 2.5, 3 million for him as well.
I think there was another Bulgarian as well that was linked to the time, and that deal didn't sort of go through. And Stillian came, and I think, again, from memory, John Barnes sort of played him. Well, I say out of position. We subsequently learned he was out of position. But I think he tended to play him at the right-hand side and wasn't really getting the best out of him. And when he was younger, I think you've maybe seen written or you've heard Stan carried a bit of weight, and he sort of found it difficult to keep the weight off. But I think when O'Neill came in and then he started to be surrounded by more senior players and better leaders and more powerful characters, that seemed to have a really positive effect in Stan, which, to be fair, I think is why he went on to become the Villa captain, the Bulgaria captain, and now speaks so articulately about the game, you know, because the guy couldn't speak English when he turned up at 19 years old. He was sort of lost in Glasgow.
I read a story that he learned English by taking a job in his mate's burger van just so he could engage with customers so he could learn the English language.
Well, his weight problem might be evidence of the blooded hands all back in 1999, but I'm not sure if that's true or not. But it's nice. I mean, if you listen to Stan speaking now, because obviously he's a Villa legend as well as a Celtic legend, but it makes me feel very proud that he still has that sort of Glaswegian lilt to his accent, you know. And he's a very much loved player. In fact, when he went through some difficult, you know, health challenges, they had a huge sort of charity match up here in Glasgow for him and sold the place out, which just shows that, you know, if you come to Celtic and you establish yourself with the fans, you this can be a sort of lifelong relationship with the club.
So Martin O'Neill had got a sort of, you know, for a good reputation in the English game, Jamie. He was very successful at Wickham and at Leicester as well. I think there's an argument that until bizarre occurrences under Claudio Ranieri hadn't happened, he would be Leicester's greatest ever manager.
He had a spell as well, and I think this probably showcases he's a principled individual as well. He had a spell at Norwich in between Leicester and Wickham, and I think on a principle of some transfer dealings, he left the club less than a handful of months, and then he went on to Leicester and had great success. But yeah, he took Wickham from the non-leagues into the leagues and then won a couple of League Cups with Leicester. So even before he's gone to Celtic, he's already proved that he's a manager that knows how to win football matches and win trophies.
I don't think there was any doubt about his credentials when he arrived, either as a player nor as a manager. When he was appointed, I think maybe to some people it was a surprise. And I say that for a few reasons, but principally because Gus Hiddink, the Dutch manager, had been so sort of heavily linked to the job for such a long time. And, you know, we found out latterly had gone through quite extensive sort of interviews for the job. But it wasn't until Dermot Desmond, who still to this day, I believe, is our largest shareholder, got involved and brought O'Neill to the table and basically said, no, this is our guy. For myself, I obviously was aware of him as the Leicester manager as much as anybody else who follows football in Scotland was. But I guess I sort of got to know his personality a little bit because he was one of the better pundits at the 1998 World Cup. I think I mean in the BBC coverage, but he went on to do it again in 2000. And, you know, he was a sort of refreshing personality in that respect. He had a different sort of humour that he brought to the table as well as his football intelligence.
Was that France? And was that where he has such a surreal moment with Robbie Williams when he comes in and starts giving career advice? Robbie Williams.
That's right. And of course, years later, I don't recall which year it was, but I do remember the famous clip where he was beside, was it Cannavaro and Arsene Vieira? And he sort of pointed out that he'd won two Champions Leagues and we had none between the two of them, and they were more respectful of who they were talking to. But again, that's sort of, you know, O'Neill's personality and charisma. And maybe a lot of us didn't really appreciate that when he got the job. Just what a fantastic sort of people manager he was and turned out to be. Because I think famously, you know, he wasn't a sort of a coach. He wasn't known for being on the training ground. He left that to John Robertson and Steve Walford. But, you know, Martin would turn up when he needed to be there, and he would say what needed to be said, either to the group or to the individuals, and, you know, sort of famously inspiring in that regard. So he was that sort of manager. He was up against like a pretty strong Rangers team. And you think, you know, Dick Advocaat was the manager there, who seemingly had a blank check to sign any Dutch player who'd ever been capped for the national team. The Boer brothers and Van Bronckhorst and Fernando Rixon and Michael Moles and Stefan Kloss, the German international. The squad full of tremendous players. I don't think he sort of showed up thinking this would be, by any stretch of the imagination, an easy job. But, you know, if you ever see clips of his appointment out, you know, he stands on the steps, the famous steps of Celtic Park, and he says, "I will do everything I possibly can to bring success to the football club." And we were all excited by that. I mean, it's just a soundbite, but we were all excited by it because we needed to end Rangers' dominance, you know, and we needed to demonstrate that we had some of the investment capacity to compete. But I think one really clever thing that Martin did in his first year was his sort of his message, because his message was really, really consistent at the beginning, which was Rangers as the benchmark. Look, Rangers are the best team. That's where we have to aspire to. Rangers are the best. Want to see it again and again and again, because he wanted to temper the expectations of fans. He wanted to make sure they realised that this was not an easy task. Well, if I think back to that early part of the season, because we won, I think, our opening game away to Dundee United, and that sort of set the tone. You could tell that something had changed the way we were playing, the way we were lining up as a 3-5-2 rather than the 4-2-2-2 that Barnes had played. We placed Rangers at Celtic Park quite early on in that season. And before the game, David Proven, unless I'm mistaken, said on Sky, you know, will this be sort of, you know, Rangers keeping the psychological upper hand on Celtic, or is this the beginning of something else? I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And Chris Sutton scored in less than 30 seconds. And then that was the tide starting to turn. Now, again, after the game, O'Neill basically said, Rangers are the benchmark, Rangers are the benchmark, Rangers are the benchmark. And it's true in as much as when the time we got to November or December and played the Irish, Rangers beat us 5-1. And a lot of people forget about that, you know, and they sort of panicked and went out and spent 12 million on Tory Andrew Flo, you know, because they were panicking about what was happening. So beating this 5-1, you know, that sent a message back. And I think maybe we drew the game after that against Hibs, and we're thinking, oh, is this all on the plan? But by the time we got to the early in the year, the engine was purring, and we went on to win the first domestic treble that Celtic had won since the Jock Stein era. I'm going to say 1969, I'm guessing, but I think that's how long it had been, which just shows what a significant achievement it actually was.
It was absolutely incredible. I was reading the interview with Martin O'Neill. Just going back to that expectation and also the strength of Rangers. Before the first game, I think Rangers play earlier in the day or the day before, and they win on TV. And then it's kind of, and there's Kirby says when he's doing his pre-interview before the Dundee United game. The first question I was asked during the pre-match interview was, now Rangers have won their opening game, is this do or die? You know, so it's already, you know, Rangers have won one game, and already it feels like the pressure is on.
Well, to an extent, we were coming off the back of a period of Rangers dominance, so maybe that was an unusual question, but we did go through the sort of O'Neill, Strachan, Advocaat, McLeish on the other side era. Sort of nip and tuck, where every result sort of counted. There wasn't a lot between it for the most part. I mean, I think Celtic did win the league in O'Neill's first season by quite a margin, and did again in the second ones. But you know, for the most part, it was all about momentum. You slip up, your opponent wins, you know, and that's how it's back to sort of operating this season, believe it or not, for the first time in a long, long time. You know, every weekend counts. Every drop point at Ross County or every home defeat to Hearts really matters at the end of the season. So. But again, I don't think any of us really expected how successful he would be so quickly. It wasn't them as a bad squad of players. It was just evidently a lack of leadership in the dressing room, a lack of leadership in the club. O'Neill sort of was the right man to change that at the right time. I mean, again, Mark Viduka is maybe like, alongside Henrik, this sort of big name player in the Barnes unit. And by the time O'Neill got there, Viduka had already decided he was leaving. They took 6 million for him, and they threw that 6 million at Chris Sutton. which was actually a stroke of genius, because Sutton was, no matter what his reputation was like at the time, a fantastic player. You know, he'd won the Premier League, the Blackburn Rovers, he'd won the Golden Boot, he'd won by season at Chelsea, and maybe made a few ill-advised decisions with regards to his international career, mm-hmm. but you're getting a top-quality player, and also a huge personality in the changing room, which is sort of what they needed. But I mean, they still had, you know, young Petrov, Larson, McNamara, Tommy Boyd, Maravchik. There was a lot in there. But Martin was also very sort of astute in terms of the players that he brought in. But he obviously had a real sort of emphasis on character and personality and strength. You know, Alan Thompson came in after a few months, and Thompson was a tremendous player, absolutely tremendous player. I mean, I'm still surprised that actually managed to get him and he didn't go to a bigger club. So he was off the charts from a Scottish perspective. Maybe the most interesting one, and this is, I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with this particular player, but there was a striker who played for Hibs whose name was Didier Agat, and he was sort of a very fast but sort of infrequent irregular scorer for Hibs. I'm not even sure how long he'd been there. One thing for sure, this guy was rapid. This guy could run like nobody had seen before, and O'Neill signed him for about $50,000 and converted into a right wing back for his 3-5-2 formation. I mean, this guy could give a player 10 yards of a head start, kick the ball 30 yards past him and get there 2 seconds before him. He was absolutely extraordinary. So the team had put together, you know, Lennon comes in, Thompson comes in, Sutton comes in, latterly in the second season Hartsood comes in, you know, Johan Hjalby at the back with Bobo Baldi. I mean, Bobo Baldi was maybe not the most technically gifted footballer I've ever seen. But not a bad player, though. I mean, fearless and powerful. But all of a sudden, you've got this, you know, this rock-hard team that can win games. I did want to make one point, though. It's more of a generic point about Peter O'Neill's tenure. We do all look back very fondly now, but he wasn't sort of averse to getting criticism now and again. And I still remember having conversations with friends who'd be kicking off because he's not playing a 4-4-2 and this isn't attractive enough. But he won more than he lost. I mean, I don't know what his overall win rate was, but it was ridiculously high over the 5 years. And so, no, it wasn't necessarily the prettiest stuff at times. And I think he did sort of convert to 4-4-2 towards the end of his tenure. For the first two or three seasons, that 3-5-2, that very direct style with Sutton and Larson up front was extremely effective.
He did inherit a decent budget. You've covered there, Martin. You touched on it as well, the genius of the Viduka transfer, because I think Viduka's a brilliant, brilliant footballer, a great career with Leeds and with Middlesbrough, actually. But was he a bit of a divisive character in the changing room? Because you referenced the Inverness game, and the joking aside, read reports that Viduka refused to come out for the second half. And I think at this point, there's a player revolt going on with John Barnes. I think the team's decided that Barnes isn't going to be their coach any longer. And Viduka's taken his boots off and said, no, I'm not going out for the second half.
Yeah. Look, I've read the same reports as you have. Look, it was evidently the nadir of the Barnes era. And I've heard many times Viduka refused to go out and various other people shouting and pointing fingers at each other and Barnes' inability to sort of get control of the situation. But again, that just shows you the depth of the issues that Celtic were facing at that particular time. The dressing room wasn't sort of short of experienced players with, you know, Tom Boyd and Paul Lambert and various others, and there was a lot of guys in there that should have been capable, you would have thought, of pulling things together and knocking heads together and so forth. But for whatever reason, weren't. And look, whether that was down to Barnes's lack of experience or his style or whatever it was, or just a bad combination of players, I really don't know. But again, it just serves to illustrate just the challenge that O'Neill had when he came into the club, because he had to pick morale up off the floor, both in the changing room and in the stands.
It's 21 points. They've lost to Leeds to Rangers, which is a massive amount of points. I mean, that suggests there's a golfing difference. I think it's Gabriel Marcotti. I don't know if you've seen it. I think he quoted he went on television saying that Celtic haven't got a chance of winning the Scottish League. There's more chance of Pamela Anderson winning an Academy Award than Celtic winning the Scottish Premier League. A bit harsh on Pamela Anderson. I think she's a pretty decent actress, really. But it kind of gives you an idea of the gulf between the two teams.
I do remember that quote and thinking it was very unfair on us, because I've seen Baywatch and it wasn't for the acting that we were watching. I didn't assure you that. Yeah, I know. I think you know, Marcotti at the time was probably just stating the obvious. I'm not sure how knowledgeable he was about the game in Scotland. But that could be unfair on Gabriel. Maybe he was, but if you're looking at a league where a team has won by 21 points, and they're having a managerial change, and the team who's winning seems to have this endless amount of money, and very experienced players and a very experienced coach, then it wasn't a bad shout. I mean, the neutral betting person probably would have thrown their weight behind Rangers as well. I don't think there's any controversy in that particular statement. But again, just goes back to the sort of nature of Scottish football, which is, you know, this is sort of a two-horse race a lot of the time. Although, as Kevin Bridges recently said, one horse fell for a while there, and we had to get on without them. But these things in Scottish football, you can never get complacent. One of the things I hate most about sort of being a Celtic supporter at the moment is the tendency to gloat. Like, don't get me wrong, I love giving it to, you know, the Rangers fans when they deserve it, and once it's finished, you can gloat too much and become complacent. And you kind of expect to win, and we should never ever expect to win. You have to earn the right to win leagues and cups all the time, no matter who you are.
Viduk was probably relatively easy to handle, given that two or three seasons before, Celtic had Pierre van Hooijdonk and Paolo Di Canio in the same forward line, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, and so maybe I didn't answer that. I remember, and you asked about Viduk before. So, look, I think we had a sort of two, three, 4 years maybe of having some really exciting attacking players. I mean, Van Hooijdonk was sort of the first one that came in. Fomi Burn signed him from NAC Breda, I think. And he was a different class at the time. His ball retention was unbelievable. His aerial ability was fantastic. We've never seen that sort of level of quality before. Certainly in my sort of era of going to matches, he was absolutely brilliant. In fact, I do remember, I'd said before about the first time I tried that game, maybe the second time was on our way to that 1995 Scottish Cup final. And if anyone's got YouTube, they can watch this one. It's the one game that's sort of forever etched in my memory. We were, I think, in the quarter final against Dundee United at home. They were winning 1-0. There was sort of just a few minutes to go. And we're all thinking, God, same again. We're going to go to the bloody cup again at Dundee United. Jackie McNamara hits a cross on the right hand side, a big high looping cross. And I'm thinking to myself, you should never loop them in like that. You've got to get the ball driven. But up went Pierre, nods in, one each. Place goes crazy. And then only 60 seconds later, another one of this glut of really exciting attacking players that were really fortunate to have. Andreas Thom went through a one-on-one after a really bad pass by Celtic support at Loan Coyle. And scored the goal. And that, for me, that was like the one of the best feelings ever as a Celtic supporter, was that 2-1 win against the United. But Andreas Thom was fantastic. And then not long after that, you did have Paolo Di Canio, an absolute loony, but a wonderful, wonderful footballer. Not really sort of held in particularly high regard by the general Celtic support anymore, given his sort of his politics and other bits and pieces, which obviously clashed with if not the majority, then the significant minority of Celtic supporters, but still a wonderful, wonderful player to watch. Another guy that maybe sometimes gets forgotten about and was sort of controversial in a different way was Georges Cadet, who came in, a very protracted move that had been held up owing to some tomfoolery, shall we call it, at the SFA, who did their best not to let Celtic register the player in time to play games. But when he did eventually play his first game, he scored in his debut against Aberdeen. And I went on to have a relatively short but successful career. But most of these players, maybe with the exception of Andreas Thom, sort of left under clouds of sorts. You know, they were all sort of bash kissers and, you know, pledged their allegiance and so forth. But, you know, when things didn't go their way or a bigger contract was made available, then they went on their merry way. And good luck to them, because, you know, they're going to make more money elsewhere, and that's what it's about for those guys. I mean, they're not brought up in Glasgow, they're not Celtic supporters like we are, so we can't expect them to hang around forever. And same with Viduka. But who knows with Viduka? He might have stayed a bit longer had the circumstances been better. But, you know, it was obviously an appalling season, and he was one of the better players. You know, when Larsson was out injured, he was sort of carrying the load for a long time. So and he went on to be a very good player elsewhere. So no surprises held against Viduka. Yeah, is he remembered as one of the greats? No.
And so, when O'Neill takes charge, you mentioned that game a little bit already, but I guess it's that first Old Firm derby is a real sort of turning point, isn't it? In fact, he talks about those first two, both the one they win 6-2 and the one they lose 5-1, as sort of both kind of really significant results for Celtic. It was sort of in different ways, obviously.
Well, as I said, the 6-2 game was the turning point. It wasn't just it was the the first Celtic Rangers game of the season and that we picked up the 3 points. It was the nature of the victory. I mean, we absolutely battered them. I know they scored twice, but that's, you know, it could have been 8, it could have been 10, but we were absolutely fantastic that day. But you're right, the 5-1 loss at Ibrox late in the year illustrated Neil's point, which is Rangers are the benchmark. Rangers are the team we have to beat. You know, you don't win leagues by winning one game. You've got to win all your games against the smaller teams in the more difficult places, not just against Rangers. But I think, though, I can't tell you the statistics off the top of my head, but I do remember that, you know, we've gone a long time without really beating Rangers very often, a long time. But we started to win most of our games, and we started to beat them at Ibrox as well. And I do remember one of my favourite games, which was maybe the following season or maybe the end of the first season, I can't remember now, but it was the 3-0 victory where Mravchik scored twice and Larsson scored as well. I could be getting that wrong. Larsson definitely scored from an acute angle and Mravchik scored a fantastic goal. But I mean, to go there and like, turn them over 3-0 at that particular time was just something I'd never really experienced before going to games. And you know, from then on through the rest of his tenure and Strachan's tenure and until Rangers were liquidated, it was always really tough. It was always really exciting. And of course, now we've gone through a period where the challenge really hasn't been there. And you know, some people were glad to see the back of Rangers for a while. Other people not so much. But no matter who you are or what your sort of political and moral view and all this, I think you'd be a liar if you said you didn't miss the excitement.
Martin, this is a period in Scottish football where it's only 12 teams in the league. So you're playing Rangers in the league 4 times every single season. Mm-hmm. That's coming from the English league, where you're used to like the home and away system, playing a team 4 times just feels that regularity is baked in. It's every couple of months you're going to be facing up against the same opponent. Does that add to the drama, the spice, the excitement that you're going to be playing this team so frequently?
Well, I don't think it detracts from it. You need to remember, like, our reality. It's not that I get fed up with questions from English colleagues about the Scottish League, but I think there's a lot of things that are sort of overlooked. Like, Scotland's a country's only 5 million people. You know, we're half the size of London. Like, so first of all, just the market is much, much smaller. And beyond that, there are lots of teams. I don't know how many top flight teams there are now, but in the top 4, there's maybe 40 odd teams. There are far too many teams. So we have to sort of cut our cloth in the most economically viable way. I mean, a lot of the teams out with Celtic Rangers and maybe arguably Aberdeen ourselves at that, and I'm not 100% sure, but for the rest of the teams, you know, having the travelling support from Glasgow 4 times a year, you know, is very valuable income and revenue for them. You know, to only have that twice a year might be the difference between being able to pay everybody's wages or not. You can't really compare Scotland to the English League or the Spanish League or the French League or the Italian League or the German League. You just can't. Like, it's so small. But if you put the positive spin on it, I mean, I'm only speaking on behalf of all the teams in Glasgow, but, you know, we punch and have punched well above our weight for years in so many different ways. I mean, you look at the statistics on European attendances. I mean, we think we're per capita the highest, or the country has the most number of supporters attending football matches. I mean, that's an extraordinary statistic. Our ability over the years to get to the finals of European competitions or even compete in Europe is extraordinary. And actually, if there's anything that links back to the Martin O'Neill era again, and maybe the most sort of exciting season, which was a bit dichotomous because we didn't win anything in the end, but it was so exciting, and that was principally because of the UEFA Cup run, where we played against 2 English teams. But that was an unusual year because we came off the back in year 2, having done really well in the Champions League. And we didn't get through to the last 16, even though we finished on 9 points. But we'd done really well and we demonstrated we could compete at that level. So the following season,
it was a tough group as well, wasn't it? I think you had Porto and Juve.
It's Porto and Rosenborg. And I think that the first game was supposed to have been at home to Rosenborg, but it was delayed or postponed because of 9-11. So that all the fixtures sort of got jumbled around. Again, you look back and O'Neill's European career at Celtic was sort of littered with incidents of misfortune. But certainly the away game in Juventus in the Champions League was one of the worst because I think we were 2-0 down, go back to 2-0. And then your man, I can't remember his first name, but it was Amoroso, took a dive, a really bad dive. Referee gave the penalty. We lose 3-2. And had we drawn that game and got to the end, because remember, we beat Juventus 4-3 at home in a class game. You know, they had Del Piero and all sorts of things playing for them. We beat them 4-3. Had we drawn that game, the Dele Alpi, we would have qualified. you know, and it was a dive. It was a blatant dive right into the game. You just can't legislate for that. But the following year, we went into the Champions League playoff with a lot of confidence and ended up losing to Basel. But Switzerland, which was really disappointing because we were also set for another Champions League campaign. But that wasn't to be. But what was to be was this rather extraordinary run to UEFA Cup final in Seville. And while we didn't win it, it was still one of the most extraordinary experiences being a Celtic supporter without any shadow of doubt. And you guys, I still know guys who were in Lisbon in 1967. That was just one game, but you know, the most memorable of all Celtic games when we became the first British team to win the European Cup. And we'd never had anything to compare that to. Now, this isn't the European Cup. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't confuse the Lisbon Lions with this team. You know, two great teams, but one, you know, all-time greats. But, you know, to go on that run, you know, to beat Blackburn at home and away, to beat Liverpool at Anfield, you know, they weren't just games for Celtic. They were sort of games representing the Scottish League and Scottish football. I think you probably will remember, if you've sort of researched this part of it, is that, you know, as soon as he made that comment to his players about being men against boys, and that was all the Celtic players needed to hear before they went to Ewood Park. And I mean, the Wyburn team were a good team, don't get me wrong, they were a good team, but we battered them down in Blackburn, and it was great to leave Souness with sort of egg on his face, him being what an ex-Rangers manager and so forth.
It pretty much killed his managerial career as well, because after that he only ever had one job, and that was a pretty poor effort in Newcastle. And then he was a Sky Sports TV pundit after that. So I think Celtic pretty much killed Graeme Souness as a football manager.
Yeah, and that was nice, I have to say. I mean, I don't really hold any bad blood against Souness. Actually, I like listening to Souness, and I think that the history books will show that he did a few good things in Scottish football. And look, this is a controversial topic, but he did sort of pushed through the decision to sign Mo Johnson.
Yeah.
And that was the first time they signed a Catholic, or a high-profile Catholic, certainly, however long it was. And while it hurt at the time, and it still hurts a lot to think about, it was a good thing for that particular club and for sort of Scottish society to sort of break down that barrier. Once we beat Blackburn, there was a sort of feeling that maybe they could go all the way here. Like, just beating a team in English league is, you know, not to be sniffed at. Stuttgart Germany game was the next round. We get through that, and then you're thinking Liverpool.
Yeah, I think that's the thing with this run. It's a real sort of narrative klaxon alert going off there. That, you know, when there are stories, it just seems like things are kind of written. And you're absolutely right. Playing Blackburn, and you know, having that head to head with Souness of all people. And then, as you say, two rounds later, of all the English teams to play against, Liverpool, with this kind of shared culture, again, it seems to be written.
Yeah, well, the game at Anfield was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the two goals were both brilliant. You know, Alan Thompson from the free kick.
What a free kick.
And then maybe John Hartson's greatest ever goal, that thunderbolt from 35 yards.
I was watching that.
And I think, you know, he had some injury troubles at the time as well, and maybe some suspensions, but he certainly was in that from the start that night when maybe he otherwise wouldn't have been.
In my mind, just every goal Hartson had ever scored was a header from inside the 6-yard box. And I know he must have scored some others. So I was re-watching it, and I kind of remembered the Alan Thompson goal. I didn't remember the Hartson's one. And I was thinking, well, from here, it looks like he's going to whack one in into the...
An absolutely brilliant goal and a brilliant performance. We struggled that night with injuries. I know there was young Jamie Smith playing on the right-hand side because we were missing one of the senior players. We didn't go into the game with a sort of full squad. So to come away with that performance, that result was extraordinary. And then the semi-final, actually, I do have my own sort of personal story about the semi-final. This is maybe the second time I ever cried at a game. Boa Vista, as you may know, is in Porto. And I was there, and I had my ticket and was sort of ready to go to the game. I was in a cafe, I guess it was the night before the game. And this is a very long, long story short, but my girlfriend at the time was studying in the south of France, in Toulouse, and I had gotten word that she'd taken ill. And I decided, with the nature of the circumstances, that I better go to where she was rather than her mother fly from Glasgow. So I handed my ticket over to a young boy who was there with his dad, who didn't have a ticket. And I made my way back to Vigo, where I was living at the time, just over the border in Spain. And the next morning, I flew to Toulouse via Madrid. By the time I got a taxi and I got to where my girlfriend was staying, she had Without going into the details, she'd had a sort of rough couple of days and had been seen by doctors and so forth, but she was sort of relatively stable. So I spent most of the afternoon with her until I had to start looking at my watch and thinking, I'm going to have to find somewhere to watch this game, because this is like 2003 in France. Like, there's not a satellite television everywhere you go. There's no iPads and other things to watch games. Like, where do you watch the game? So I spent what felt like 3 hours like running around the centre of Toulouse, which is a big rugby town. Couldn't find anywhere to watch this game. And I was just running out of hope when I went around the corner and I see a pub, and the pub was called the Frog and Roast Beef. And I sort of, oh, it looked quite quiet. Opened up the door, crazy full of Celtic supporters, many of whom worked at they were engineers from the local Airbus factory. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of tired and emotional having, you know, left there. And of course, you know, Larson scores for that last minute winner to win the game 1-0 to get through the final. And I just remember the tears coming down sort of uncontrolled. And that was a really special moment. And then, of course, on to Seville.
Just on the frog and roast beef point, I mean, you make a really good point. And it relates back to your story about being in North America and Canada when you know, 60 or 70 guys watching Celtic when you were there. I mean, it goes without saying, I mean, Martin, you're completely aware of this, but for anyone who's kind of lived under a rock for a while, Celtic are a massive, massive football club. You know, it's considered to be around about 10 million worldwide fans for Celtic. I mean, this is huge levels. I mean, you just get into like the top 10, top 15 of most followed football teams of around the world right now. I think there's something like 160 supporter clubs around the world as well. They're watched everywhere. It doesn't surprise me that you've walked into a bar and it's full of Celtic fans. I've been to many places where Celtic's been playing, and pubs are always full. The bars are always full with Celtic fans. They are an absolute massive football club.
Well, it's largely down to the Scottish-Irish diaspora all around the world. And, you know, Celtic means a lot to a lot of people and a lot of families. I've watched Celtic games all over the world. As recently as 4 weeks ago in Dubai and Magetti against Bar, there was a ram full of people watching the game. But when I went to Canada in 1999, again, this is like free internet. Well, not free internet, but before I had access to internet and before iPhones and so forth, I wrote a letter. I basically got an address from Celtic Football Club, and I wrote a letter before I went there to a guy called McKenna. I can't remember his first name, but his nephew ended up playing for Hearts, a guy called Kevin McKenna, Canadian international. And when I got there, he'd left a voicemail on the old, you know, remember the old answering machines and the phones to the place that I was staying. I'd given the number, and he'd left me, if you want to come along, it costs $15 Canadian per game. This is the address. It turned out it was in what was by afternoon and evening a strip club called Studio 82, but in the mornings it was a Celtic supporters club. And what was really interesting about it, actually, now that I think about it, they used to get the rights from Setanta. So before Setanta was a channel, but they used to have the rights, and you would buy the package, but it came with the Celtic and the Rangers games. So they would sort of like open up to Rangers supporters as well, but they gave them like a corner. And charge an extra, and there weren't as many of them, but it was sort of seen as an extra revenue stream for the supporters. But it was full of people, and you're right. You know, it's marvelous. Anywhere you go in the world, you'll see, you know, somebody wearing green and white hoops, and someone will say, "One hoops across, is he worth away or something?" And you sort of acknowledge, and yes, it's a remarkable football club. It really is.
The Seville final is now. Interestingly, we've covered this from the other end because we did Porto, we did Jose Mourinho's Porto a few months back, and this is his kind of the making of him, really, or part of the making of him. Well, the real making of Mourinho is when he does his double knee slide at Old Trafford, obviously. But, you know, this is a decent Porto side, but it would have gone to Seville with reasonable optimism.
Absolutely. I think at that particular time we thought we could beat anybody. This was Mourinho before anyone knew who Mourinho was. I mean, if you were to Google the starting lineup for that Porto team, you sort of shrug your shoulders and you go, well, you know, guys like Deco and Derlei and some of the players that went on to Carvalho, and these guys went to play for Chelsea, and they were a good team. I'm not as bitter towards all these people now as once I was, although if I ever meet the goalkeeper Vitor Baia in the flesh, I'll have a few harsh words from the team. But no, I think that whole week was really extraordinary from sort of beginning to end. I mean, the worst part of it always was sort of the hours after the game where many of us felt very deflated. Some people were just happy to go that far and we're all celebrating. I felt quite deflated. I thought we deserved more, but the whole experience was sort of once in a lifetime stuff. It really was. I mean, as I say, I was living in the north of Spain at the time, and I'd made my way down via Lisbon, and I remember getting to, this is on the, either the Sunday or the Monday, and met a small group of Scottish people who were on their way to Seville, but had sort of got lost, in as much as they'd spoken to the woman at the bus station, they're trying to buy tickets for Seville. She's saying to them, you can't get tickets to Seville from here. But what she really meant is, to get to Seville, you have to go somewhere else first. So I sort of got involved in the conversation, and we struck up a, you know, friendship, and I sort of sat with them in the bus, and I ended up sleeping head to toe in a single bed with one of the guys that night in a hostel by the time we got to Seville. And it was that sort of, everybody sort of mucked in, because there were so many people there. I mean, you see all sorts of reports, you know, 70, 80, 90. Mm. I have no idea how many people were there, but the city was green and white for the whole week. And what was truly remarkable, and you remember, UEFA gave the Celtic supporters this sort of fair play award, as there was no arrests, which is staggering. I'm not sure we would get away with that nowadays. But it was so many families and people there that it was all sort of self-policed and self-controlled. And the locals, to be fair, them really embraced it as well. And this was May in Seville, so there was a lot of sunburned people as well, a lot of dehydrated. But the experience was marvellous. And I stayed that first night with the guys that I met in the bus, but my uncle Jerry and my cousin Louisa and a few people had come over. And he actually had a room in the hotel where the Porto team were staying. So quite a fancy hotel. And there was also sort of lots of ex-Celtic players knocking about. So he'd obviously got himself, you know, pretty decent digs. But I do remember, as we were leaving for the game, the sort of the pathway between the foyer and out to the Porto bus was all cordoned off. And the Celtic fans were all shouting, Bobo's going to get you, Bobo's going to get you. And it was all very good natured, but, you know, the Porto players were sort of, for those who had cameras, were like filming and taking photographs of the Celtic supporters and about the bus, all smiling, not intimidated at all. But that was just such a fantastic few days. And then the game itself, I mean, Henrik Larsson was out of this world, absolutely fantastic. They had slightly more possession of the ball, and I think we found it difficult at times. I think O'Neill, on reflection, probably might have taken off Balde after his booking. Certainly we get into extra time. You know, Bobo could be reckless at times and took out one of their players, got a red card, and we finished off the game with 10 men, and we were just that bit short when they scored the third goal. A lot of guys blamed Rab Douglas for not pushing the ball to the side when the first shot came in. But to be fair to Rab, you know, it wasn't his fault. And the better team didn't win. I don't think. I thought there wasn't much between it. And the best player in the park didn't win the game. But he did go on to win the European Cup a few years later. So all's well ends well for Henrik.
It's quite contrasting just hearing you talk back, Martin, about the volume of Celtic fans that travelled to Seville for this final. Graham and I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago on Steaua Bucharest, who also got to see a European Cup final to play Barcelona in Seville. And they had less than 1,000 people travel to Seville, and that was mostly dignitaries, because obviously it was under communism when travel wasn't exactly that easy to do. But it's incredibly contrasting, you know, how a following, and to broaden it out, I mean, Scotland is incredibly well known for travelling fans and good-humoured and goodwill as well. I mean, we did the great Scotland 1978 team with Stefan a few months ago, which was fantastic. And I think there were still Scots now actually living in Argentina that travelled, you know, took 30, 40 days to get down to Argentina and just decided to spend the rest of their life down there. It's an incredible contrast for so many people to travel to a single football match, knowing that in the likelihood, they're not even going to get a ticket to get, they just want to be part of the experience happening.
Most people went there knowing they weren't going to get in to see the game. And to be honest, I went there not expecting to see the game either. And I still have a little bit of guilt that I got a ticket in the end, because I'd been living in Spain that year and hadn't been to many home games. I'd been to some of the European games, believe it or not, in Celta Vigo, where I had been living at the time, but I'd not seen many of the games. But my uncle Jerry, he of the expensive hotel room with the Porto players, managed to get 4 tickets at face value from some contact in Spain the morning of the game, which was just extraordinary. So, you know, that was one of the more memorable games of my life, in spite of the result.
And that's, of course, also had the lesser-spotted silver goal, didn't it? So technically, it's something I hadn't even realised existed. I remember the golden goal, but the silver goal, what on earth was that, Jamie?
So the silver goal was, it came after the golden goal, and it tried to lessen the kind of the psychological impact that when a goal is scored in golden goal, that's the end. And it can be quite demoralizing, not just for the players, but also for the fans. So the silver goal was introduced to kind of like lessen that. So if you scored a silver goal in the fourth minute of the first half of added time, you would continue to play all of the rest of the minutes of that half, but you wouldn't play a second half if no further goals were scored. So it kind of softened the golden goal psychological effects.
I don't think I remember that. I don't think I remember the silver goal from... Don't move on that one, yeah. It is worth saying that all the time this is going on, so I don't know where this is in the cycle, because Celtic are also having just the most unbelievable contest with Rangers for the league championship that year as well, aren't they, or for the premiership?
Yeah, well, I mean, it all sort of came to a head in a week after we lost in Seville, and we actually lost on the last day of the season. So it was pretty demoralising for the players to have sort of performed at such a high level for the whole season and then come away with absolutely nothing. I mean, no cups, no league, no, it was zero trophies that year. Quite staggering to think about now when you consider just, you know, the calibre of time we had and the performances we've been. Very disappointing.
It would have been a final day, an absolute thrill ride for the fans, because it was down to goals. And going into the game, there was only a couple of goals between the two teams. I think the Rangers had a couple of goals advantage or a goal advantage, maybe less than that. And I think it was a case of not only did both teams need to win, but they needed to outscore each other as well. I think it finished by, I think Rangers won the league by just one goal in terms of the goal difference.
I watched that particular game at a place called the Michael Collins Bar in Barcelona with a whole bunch of other Celtic supporters who had made their way sort of up the coast and round after the game in Seville. We were all sort of a bit fatigued, but you know, excited for the potential league victory. But for the life of me now, I can't remember. It was Rangers that were either Kilmarnock or Dunfermline. I can't remember if that's the year of Chris Sutton's infamous "we knew they were going to lie down to them" line, or if it was the Kilmarnock away game. I honestly can't remember. I've probably blocked it from my mind because I was so depressed about it. Although I do remember that between the game in Seville and the final game of the season, I did get to see the Galacticos Real Madrid in the Mestalla against Valencia with the whole Ronaldo, Figo, Roberto Carlos shooting match, which was the sort of the highlight of the week in terms of results.
It is the typical, coming off after the cup final. It's so difficult to be able to go one more time on that. And you do see, and it happens actually a surprising amount, doesn't it, where you see teams that, I mean, Liverpool, happened to Liverpool not that long ago, where you're going on so many fronts, but emotionally, and you know, especially for Celtic, having got to extra time and the roller coaster attached to that final, so difficult to go again.
Yeah, I mean, these games take an emotional and a physical toll on players. And again, remember in those days it was different. It was, you only had three subs and the squads were sort of leaner, and it's not like now where the number of subs seems to change every week, as far as I can tell. But you know, you've got bigger squads and you can spread the load physically and emotionally among your squad. But yeah, I mean, look, that era, that Martin O'Neill era, you know, we went from expecting nothing to expecting to win everything. And that says a lot about what Martin O'Neill did for the club and for the mentality as a mindset shift. And I would argue that if you set aside the sort of the business side of the club, I think that put us on the path to where we are right now, actually, which is we have this sort of serial winning mentality, which I know from the outside might look kind of easy sometimes to win, but it's really not. You know, every time you play against a team, it's a cup final for them. Okay, Rangers have not been as strong recently as they were in O'Neill's era, but there needed to be a mindset shift from the sort of the Tommy Burns, the Wim Jansen, Okie Hewyn, and Joe Bent, from that era where you might win now and again to winning consistently. And I think that's maybe O'Neill's legacy at Celtic, was the winning mentality. So that one year where we lost in the UEFA Cup final and we lost to Rangers in the League Cup final and we lost in the last day of the league to Rangers and we got knocked out of the Scottish Cup, that was not a great year for winning, but it was one of the most memorable years for a Celtic supporter. But it came at a time where we won a lot more than we lost, and we'll never forget that.
Yeah, Jamie, Martin O'Neill's record as a manager at Celtic quite impressive, isn't it?
Well, the win ratio, 75.5%. I mean, I think it's fair to point out a lot of Celtic managers have pretty high win ratios, but 75.5% is still incredible. It's the highest. Josh Steen, as an example, is 70%. And second on the list, actually, is Big Ange, who's doing a fairly okay-ish job.
Brendan Rodgers isn't number one now. It surprised me if Rodgers wasn't number one from his first.
Brendan Rodgers, I can tell you, is 69.8%, actually.
Wow. What a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, he had an incredible run, I think. Also, in this Marcelino nil team, I think, didn't they go 25 league? It was 25 wins on the bounce?
Under a nil?
Yeah, which I think is a nil, which I think is a record as well.
And 7 Old Firm derby wins in a row.
They're all, I knew that one. I knew you were saying there was a long, long unbeaten streak. Yeah. I couldn't have told you it was 25 games, to be honest. I do remember the Celtic Rangers.
I think it was the third championship or the second, maybe, where he finished with 103 points. I think they only drew 4 games and they only lost 1 game to Aberdeen in that
hole. That was the record points hole. Yeah, that's true. I think maybe the one regret he would have, and he's probably spoken about it many times, would just be Europe. Setting aside the UEFA Cup, but the Champions League, he never managed to get us through the group stages. Whereas when Strachan came in, he managed to get us through to the last 16 in 2 consecutive years with arguably a team that wasn't quite as strong. So, you know, a lot depends on your luck of the draw, luck of the performance in the night and so forth. But, you know, Strachan, to his credit, didn't happen once, happened twice in 2 consecutive seasons. And I think that's maybe the one thing that O'Neill wishes he could have done while he was there.
As you say, to get 9 points in a qualifying group would normally get you, in most years, that gets you through it. As you say, it's just the circumstances of the fortune there. Because he sort of crops up all the time because he scores a lot. Henrik Larsson, I mean, having sort of watching him play during that, I mean, why was he so good, or was he that good?
Well, without any shadow of a doubt, I think that we all knew how good he was, because not only were we seeing him play in the Scottish League against arguably weaker defenders, but I would say arguably only as much as, you know, these are strong defensive teams you're playing against. When they come up to play against Celtic, they set their stall out, they're aggressive. You know, you have to have tremendous movement, you have to have tremendous balance and vision and touch to score as many goals as Larsson did. But he sort of had, like, everything in his locker. He was extremely unselfish, first and foremost. He was a great finisher. He was unbelievable in the air for his height. I don't know what height it was, but he wasn't a Sutton or a Hartson in terms of stature, but scored a tremendous amount of goals with his head. But more importantly, scored in big games regularly. Whether it was Barcelona or Juventus or whoever else, he'd score in the big games. And then equally, whenever you saw him go off to either the World Cup or the European Championships, he'd be there scoring in the big games again, whether it's against England or Italy or Bulgaria or whomever else. You know, you don't do that if you're only a decent player. You do that if you're a really good player. So, of course, when he left us in his last game, you might have seen the footage of his tears coming down his face with about 10, 15 minutes to go. And he scores a couple of goals in his last appearance to win the game. But, you know, he's extremely emotional. You know, obviously, it's a real emotional wrench leaving the club. But he made his decision earlier that year. He went to Barcelona. He came back to Celtic Barcelona the next year and scored against us and didn't celebrate. But his career at Barcelona was fantastic. You know, he came on in the Champions League final. He made the difference in that game, set up 2 of their goals. I sort of used to read a lot more of the Spanish press than I do now, having lived there for a long time. But, you know, I always remember, you know, guys like Ronaldinho and others would always single out Larsson for praise because of how effective a teammate he was. You know, he was always sort of there, always available. Completely unselfish, made things tick. And so none of us were surprised. And again, Manchester United, he was only there for 3 months or whatever, and he probably wishes he could have spent a bit more time there. But he was another one of these guys, very loyal. When he signed a contract, he would stick to it. And he went back to Helsingborg in Sweden. But yeah, he was a terrific player. He's the best player I've ever seen in a Celtic jersey. I mean, I know I mentioned before Lubin Maravcic, but he was, you know, off the charts in terms of skill and creativity and flair and so forth. But in terms of being a big game player, Larsson's definitely the head and shoulders above anything else we've ever had.
I was fortunate enough to watch him a few times in that short spell at Manchester United, and he was fantastic. He gave United the boost they needed, because this is when Mourinho was dominating with Chelsea. It looked like Chelsea were going to win the league every season. He just gave United a massive boost, and they were able to break that stranglehold that Chelsea had. But just watching him up close and personal, it was just his movement, his energy, the way he just understood space. He just seemed to have, he just seemed that fraction of a second ahead of so many other players on the park. Yeah, I was gutted that he was only there for 3 months, because I'd love him to stay for longer and longer.
Yeah, I think like a lot of these great players, they look to always have time. They sort of float around, they've got tremendous balance and awareness and vision. They always look like they've got time, and I think Larsson was like that. He read the game extremely well, but his movement and his unselfishness were two of his best qualities.
Definitely didn't look out of place in the Premier League. Just out of curiosity, Martin, I think this is about the time when the whole kind of Celtic and Rangers move into the English Premier League question was rearing its head. Now, obviously, it's hypothetical, but how do you think this O'Neill team would have fared in the English Premier League? So this would have been when Wenger's Invincibles would have been around, when Ferguson had just won the European Cup, when Abramovich's money had come in and Ranieri was there. So during that era, how do you think the Celtic, bearing in mind they beat Liverpool in a quarterfinal, how do you think they would have done in the English Premier League?
So just to be clear on your hypothetical, we're just lifting and dropping that one particular team at that one particular time into the league.
Yeah, because I think the logistics are kind of...
Celtic get on an English league title question.
Yeah, no. I don't really want to go down that rabbit hole, to be honest.
To be honest, I think... look, a hypothetical question, a hypothetical answer. I think they would have competed towards the top of the league. I think whether they would have had the strength and depth to go a whole season and to win the league, or even to be in the top two, I think would probably be debatable. They certainly, with a full team, a full fit team, they could have beaten anyone on their day. But as we said before, like, you don't win leagues just by winning on the day. You have to win over 36 or 38 games. And I'm not sure, if you look kind of down into the squad, certainly in that Seville year, good players, and players who were sort of on their way up, you know, guys like Sean Maloney and Jamie Smith, but any guys like David Fernandez and others who maybe wouldn't necessarily have been there had we had more money, more investment, or the need to have better players. So I think we might have struggled over the course of a season, but certainly starting 11 against the best starting 11 in English league, we would have competed without any shadow of a doubt.
So O'Neill, that period lasts 5 years. It's an impressive roster, three league titles, the treble, the European adventures, even the seasons they don't win the title, they lose by, I think it's a point and a goal. And so it's, you know, they run everything as close as they can. He steps down to look after his wife, who's sick at the time. But really, I suppose, coming back to your point, really, he has established a legacy, hasn't he? Because what Celtic go on to do, and, you know, Rangers are starting to implode, but Rangers have been proper opponents there, isn't it? There's been a good Rangers, but Celtic really take a sort of stranglehold on things after building on the Martin O'Neill legacy, I guess.
From a football perspective, yes. As I say, I think it was a mindset shift. I think all of a sudden we had sort of pride in the team again, and we knew about the quality and the character to win league titles again regularly and to win cups again regularly. I think without going down a whole other rabbit hole, I think one thing that's important, though, to sort of recognise in terms of what's propped up the success has been the business side of the club. Because for those who don't know sort of the history, and I didn't mention it before, even though we started back in 1988, but Celtic were very, very close to going into administration in the early 90s because of a lot of sort of fiscal mismanagement over a number of years by what was the incumbent board, people who were sort of just desperate to cling on to power and were taking decisions that were by no means in the interest of the football club. And we had a sort of Scottish-born Canadian businessman called Fergus McCann who came over and essentially saved the club on the day that it was going to go out of business. You know, he had got word that there was a deadline, which was 12 o'clock, 12 noon on a particular day, and he left, I think he was in the US that particular time, and flew to Glasgow, went straight there, and put down his own money to effectively save the club. And as he said in interviews since, it would have been easier to sort of let the club go out of business and start again. But, you know, that wasn't the way the Celtic did things. Everyone had to be paid. So he paid the bills, and he came in with a new plan. And the plan was to bring sort of financial stability to the club over the long term. It was to build a new stadium and make sure it was a place that the supporters could be proud of, and to put in the investment to get the playing staff back to a level that we would expect. And that really set us on a path to where we are just now. And it's been frustrating at times for Celtic supporters over the years, because we think we should spend more money. But we've seen what happens when you don't look after your bank balance. You know, we saw what happened to Rangers. I mean, the reckless chairman, a guy called David Murray, who I'm sure he thought was doing the right thing at the time, famously said, "For every £5 that Celtic spend, we'll spend 10. And then they got themselves embroiled in a financial mire and were liquidated and went out of existence in whenever it was, 2011, 2012. And now you've got, it's still the Rangers supporters, the same, but it's a different club entirely. And it was a real shame for the supporters of that particular team, because it didn't need to be that way. But I would say that for us, you know, we've put ourselves in a real sort of firm, stable financial footing with good shareholders. We've been able to invest in the playing staff in a way that we couldn't have anticipated when I was younger. And, you know, we have to appreciate that we've had it good for a long time, but that's on the business side of the club. On the football side, O'Neill started that legacy of winning, which carried on through Strachan. We had a little blip under Tony Mowbray, and by the time Ronnie Dealer took over from Neil Lennon, Rangers weren't there. And then he came back and we had Brendan Rodgers, and then for a fleeting and beautiful moment, Ange Postecoglou. And then he left to go out with a richer and better looking girl. And we got Brendan back again. So
the energy is what were the energy is like? Because, like, I think it had sort of passed me by, and I think I haven't really watched a lot of Celtic under Ange, and well, my eyes get reopened to it all when I see Spurs start off like a train. But the football was fantastic, wasn't it? Celtic under Ange,
it's the most exciting football I've ever watched. I mean, the first few games, and we lost a few games, and you're going, "My God, what's going on here?" But I mean, it was relentless. It was heart attack football. Me and the guys that sits next to me, we were just holding our chests half the time, because we didn't know whether you could keep breathing watching this stuff. When it all started to click, it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I mean, it was difficult when you played against, though. We played against Real Madrid in the Champions League, and in the first half, we absolutely blew them away. Callum McGregor hit the post with a shot of about 30 yards, like the inside of the post, and went across the line. Now, had that gone in, you're thinking to yourself, "My God, Real Madrid have never played a team like this before." Unfortunately, they went into half-time, and Toni Kroos, Luka Modric thought, "Fuck, we better get an Arsenal here." And they were outstanding in the second half, and they both got applauded off the park, and we lost the game 3-0. But look, for those 45 minutes, I mean, just staggering football to watch. Absolutely brilliant. But it was more than just the style of football. It was him himself. It was his backstory. He was an immigrant managing a club based on immigrants. And everything's just sort of clicked together. You know, he treated the media with utter contempt, which is totally necessary to survive in this goldfish bowl in the west of Scotland. He was just a good person, and we all loved him. And it still makes me sad to think that he's not here.
Right, well, we should probably get to ranking this great Celtic team. As well, we have five categories of greatness, from all-time greats at the top to true greats, down to touch of greatness, age of greatness, and blink of greats. And Jamie, I will start with you again. You can give your... I will give you the first shot. What do you reckon? Where do you place this team?
I mean, it's just an absolute bucket of brilliance, really. O'Neill, we've talked about, clearly is a brilliant manager, as well as knowing the right people to put in the back room. And I think that's what he's done here to kind of set Celtic up for success and to win the treble in his very first season and to overhaul a 21-point gap from the nearest rivals, Rangers. It's just fantastic. And I love the way that he manages the expectations in his first season as well. He's loading the pressure onto Rangers. It's all about Rangers, as Martin's mentioned. We talked about the records and the stats, 25 game winning run, the 103 points, which is a record. Fantastic players. Henry Larsson, one of my favourite players I think I've seen, but, you know, just a brilliant collection of players. And bringing life back into Chris Sutton, a footballer who probably had seen better days. Martin O'Neill is the right fit for Chris Sutton. everything about them tells me all-time greats, apart from one thing, and it's that European voodoo. It's fallen at the final hurdle. And, you know, Martin, you mentioned about the Champions League, and it would have been nice to see Celtic go deep into the Champions League to make the last 16 under O'Neill, or even, you know, the last eight, which would have been absolutely thrilling, you know, to see Celtic, you know, Celtic Park rocking in the quarterfinals of the European Cup would be fantastic. But we didn't get that. We got a flavour of it in the UEFA Cup run. But unfortunately, Celtic came up against an upstart in Jose Mourinho, whose tactics were just a little bit too... waited against Celtic to win a European trophy. So all of that said, ranty. I'm going to go the second tier, Graham, and put this particular Celtic team as true greats and kick us off there.
True greats, Martin.
What do you reckon?
It's such a great question, Graham. I'm just reflecting as Jamie's talking there. I think true greats is generous. If we're talking, you know, of all the teams from a Celtic perspective, I'm just thinking about Celtic. I think true greats are totally spot on. I mean, there has only ever been one team of all-time greats at Celtic, and that, of course, was the 1967 team that won five trophies, including the European Cup. And what made that team all the more remarkable, as I'm sure you're both well aware, is that all of the players came within a very, very small radius around Glasgow. They were pretty much all from Glasgow, apart from Bobby Lennox, who came from Saltcoats, which is on the Ayrshire coast. And it's never happened since, and will obviously never happen again. And those guys are the all-time greats. Does this team come close to that team? Probably not. But certainly in the modern era, they're the best Celtic team. One of the discussions we sort of have recently is how would the modern team get on against O'Neill's team? How would Rodgers' invincible team get on against O'Neill's team? And to be fair, like, O'Neill's team would have too much. I mean, with Henrik Larsson alone, you're dialing up to a level of quality that the modern team couldn't compete with. But then you throw in just the muscle of Lennon and Thompson and Lambert and Sutton and Hartson and Volgarin and Balde and Mjalby. These beasts who can also play football, you know, you'd be hard-pushed to rank them anything outside true greats from a purely Celtic perspective. From a global perspective, they're probably in the third category. I think that's what they would be if you take all the great teams into account. But I'm happy with where Jamie's put us.
Yeah, I think you sum it up absolutely spot on. I think, you know, if they'd won UEFA Cup final, the case for true greats would be stronger. But I just think it's the weight of expectation. And I think if you put this story in the context of what O'Neill achieves, really, that if you look at the decade he's followed, and pretty much from the instant he walks into the building, as they like to say in football, the moment he's in the building, it just all changes. And that is the mastery of man. Both man. And to the fact I'm an absolutely massive Martin O'Neill fan. I just think he's one of the greatest men in football, I have to say. It's interesting, he already sort of touched on it, but he's obviously taken the best bits of Brian Clough's man management, or survived the Brian Clough experience in one way or another. And that shows through, and I think when you, again, and we have this every now and then, I think probably the head would say touch greatness, but the heart says true greats. So for that reason alone, I think Martin O'Neill Celtic, true greats.
I just got a couple of things. I mean, they're more kind of loose things that don't really knit the thing together. But one of the things I like about Martin O'Neill as well, he clearly has loyalty, because he takes Steve Guppy with him from Wickham to Leicester, and he also brings him to Celtic, where he doesn't have Martin, I don't know if you remember Steve Guppy. He did play a few games at Celtic. But then even after Steve Guppy leaves, he makes sure that Martin O'Neill makes sure he's taken care of and kind of nurses him back to Leicester. So he's got those wonderful qualities of just looking after his particular favourites.
Yeah, I mean, Lennon was the guy who was with them all the way through. He signed Lennon from Crewe Alexandra for
Wickham,
and they welcomed to Leicester to Celtic. Guppy, I think, I don't know if he was there one or two seasons, but he played about 30-odd games. But he was sort of ideal for the system. You know, he played out on the left-hand side. He was an exceptional crosser of the ball. That was all he was there to do, getting the ball a Guppy. He'd cut outside, swinging these fantastic balls. You get Larsen, Sutton, Hartson there on the end of it. You know, he's not a guy that, you know, you would put in your sort of all-time Celtic 11, but he fitted the model. But you're right, you know, he was a loyal guy. I know that he also tried to bring Matt Elliott to the club at one point, but that sort of fell through at the last minute because I think Elliott got a big contract offer from Leicester. But yeah, no, I think who was the other guy, the Turkish English guy, Muzzy Izzet quite a few times. He was apparently linked with the move to Celtic.
He was always linked. Yeah. Well, that's the classic football journalist trick who did he use to manage? Okay, yeah, we'll link him.
There's another question I had for you, Martin, actually, because Graham and I, ages ago, we kind of gave up because we just couldn't find 11, but we started fielding a team of footballers based on nominative determinism. I think we really got a couple, didn't we? We started off with David Speedy, and the question was David Speedy? And there was a player, I think John Barnes may have signed him, a Brazilian, for $5 million as well. And I think he was called Raphael Scheidt. So I just wondered, Was Raphael shite?
I'm not sure Raphael played enough games to have been shite. He sort of, I don't know the real story. I'm told that he was signed after they'd watched videos of him when he played for Corinthians. I don't know if anyone ever actually going to scout him, but we paid something ridiculous, like $4.3 million for him. I don't know how many games he played, maybe 4 or 5 or 6 or something like that. And then he got injured and then he was never seen or heard of again. But as far as nominative determinism goes, he was definitely in your starting 11 without any shadow of a doubt.
Brilliant. Excellent. Okay, we should leave it there. Martin, thank you so much for taking us through this fantastic Celtic side. Some good memories there, I think.
Absolutely. It's made me feel very old thinking back to that particular pre-internet era. The one thing I did remember, just as a final sort of anecdote, obviously, before you could listen to games on the internet or anywhere else, I lived abroad, whether it was in Canada, we had the supporters club, and I was in Spain and in Europe, I would have to go and buy a telephone card. And you'd get like 360 minutes for €5 or whatever it was in pesetas at the time. And I would phone home, and my dad would put the house phone in front of the radio, and I would stand in the telephone box and listen. And then even when I got to the O'Neill era, I remember being in Toulouse around about the same time, going into like the telephone cabin shops. Remember you used to get shops that lots of telephones, and you'd phone back from one of them, and you'd listen to Radio Clyde for 2 hours, hang up and then go on your way. So life has changed so much since then.
That's fantastic. Fantastic. Brilliant. Jamie, thank you again.
Martin, thank you so much. It's been wonderful just listening to your accounts of following this incredible football team, bringing light to it as well. And some of your personal stories are brilliant. So, thank you so much for sharing.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And I think if you want to come back on, you obviously be very welcome. And if we could do Celtic 66, 67, the Lisbon Lions. But I think, Graham, we'd have to start at the very beginning saying all-time greats is what we've already decided. And then we have to prove the case that's not.
That would make a decent hour-long chat, I have to say.
Definitely so. Excellent. Okay, that's really all we have time for. We are getting towards the end of our season, but we do have coming up shortly, we have our end-of-year promotion and relegation special, where we just go through our previous rankings and move people up or down depending on what we think. We've also got a cup final special, which we're focusing on the great Coventry City winning side of the 80s, and we'll be doing a Euro 96 special just ahead of the Euros. So keep listening, and we'll speak again soon.